Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office recently issued a scathing report criticizing itself and the Philadelphia Police Department. In a lengthy report on wrongful convictions, District Attorney Larry Krasner takes aim at his predecessors and certain police officers who he says committed, quote, horrendous abuses of power. 3 years ago, the DA's office launched a new conviction integrity unit to identify and reverse wrongful convictions. So far, the unit has helped exonerate 21 people. 21 people who spent a collective 384 years behind bars for crimes they did not commit. But the unit has taken plenty of heat from judges, police officers, even some of its own prosecutors for its work in reversing certain convictions. Patricia Cummings heads up the Conviction Integrity Unit. She joins us in studio, and in just a little while, we will also hear from Theophilus Bilal Wilson, one of the people that she helped to exonerate. Patricia Cummings, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So this report, District Attorney Krasner's recent report entitled Overturning Convictions and an Era, really is kind of a no-holds-barred account of what he describes as I mentioned, horrendous abuses of power by both the DA's office and the Philadelphia Police Department. I mean, what kinds of behaviors is he talking about here?
Wow. I could probably spend the whole hour talking about that, so I'll try to give you a short answer to the question. I think more than anything else, what he's talking about is a history of both the police department and the prosecutors withholding what we as lawyers always call as Brady information. And really what that is withholding favorable information from the defense prior to trial that had the defense had it, it could have potentially led to a different result.
Yeah. Why is that? Why does that happen? Why is evidence withheld?
Super complicated question, and you could get answers on various points on the spectrum. Sometimes what you have are you have horrendous abuses where it's withheld intentionally. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you have negligent failure to turn the information over, and sometimes that could be anything from tunnel vision, not really understanding what it is, to not really understanding what the law is regarding the obligation to turn it over.
How widespread a problem would you say it is?
Oh, I think it's a widespread problem across our entire country. And if you look at jurisdictions throughout the country, you're going to see that prosecutors' offices and police departments have responded to the awareness of it as a problem in very different ways.
So it's interesting you mentioned the rest of the country. How does Philly stack up? Do we have any way of knowing how we stack up in this area to the rest of the country?
Trying to figure out if I can answer that based on research or if I have to give you an anecdotal answer. And in fairness, I think you probably get a little bit of both. Recently, Sam Gross did a report that was released in September of 2020. And specifically, what he was talking about was how government misconduct contributes to wrongful convictions. And if you look closely at that report, it's pretty clear that Philly ranks pretty high. On the one hand, I'd say if anybody in the audience is interested to take a deep dive into it, they ought to take a look at that report. On the other hand, there's our report that we released in June. And what we did is we looked at the work that we've done, and it is mind-blowing, to be honest with you, when you look at all the cases and you see that official misconduct occurred in almost every single one of them. So I think, and this is me, a lawyer who's practiced in a few different jurisdictions, I think Philly has a particularly big problem when it comes to this type of abuse.
I read that there are something like 1,165 backlogged cases yet to review.
Right. And that number's changed because it changes daily, because in addition to us looking at cases and trying to make our way through them, we're constantly getting new requests in the door. So it's hard to keep up with that statistic. As I said in the report, it's not surprising that we have that many requests to review cases, because it's important to understand that really what we're being asked to look at are homicide convictions where people are serving life without parole. And as most people who pay attention to criminal justice issues know, Philadelphia in particular and Pennsylvania in general has one of the highest populations of people serving life without parole in the entire country.
Yeah. And so many of those people are black men. What does that tell us about how people of color in general and black men in particular are treated in the criminal justice system?
simply put, it tells us that our criminal justice system is racist. And that's a hard thing to say out loud. It's a hard thing for people to accept. But the reality is, we know it. Research tells us that. And specifically with the work that we're doing in Philadelphia, that tells us that.
Yeah. A couple of things come up. You mentioned other cities acknowledging these kinds of issues. Is this part of a national reckoning, do you think, as it relates to criminal justice?
I think absolutely it is. And this national reckoning has been going on for over two decades now. And you kind of have to trace it back to really an awareness that our criminal justice system is fallible. So many of the problems we have, aside from the racism that I just referenced, is that we've got a pretty arrogant system, a system that believes that it generally has believed that it's not capable of making mistakes. We had to face the reality, though, and we started facing that reality when we started seeing DNA exonerations. And it's so important to reference the DNA exonerations because they not only told us that we got it wrong in regard to an individual that was convicted, but in a lot of them, they also tell us who the real perpetrator was. So when we study the issue, DNA exonerations essentially are the gold standard. And so we absolutely know that we've gotten it wrong. And as a result, what you can see is, in particular, in prosecutors' offices throughout the country, prosecutors are saying, not only does the problem exist, but we need to do something about it. And quite frankly, what we see them doing about it is that they are forming conviction integrity units. I think we now have over 95 conviction integrity units throughout the country, which is remarkable because when they first started back in about 2007, most people thought that they were kind of a flash in the pan, that there was no way that they would really catch on. And if they did, were they just going to last for a short period of time? The thinking for some skeptical prosecutors were or was that the DNA cases would run out. And so once the DNA cases ran out, the work would be over. And of course, we know, and particularly we especially know in Philadelphia, it's not always DNA that exonerates individuals. It is things such as Brady information that lies hidden in files for decades until it finally sees the light and tells us we got the wrong person.
Well, and what's so interesting about having these kinds of units within the DA's office, I mean, so often we think of like the Innocence Project, or we think of organizations outside of the main criminal justice system and outside of district attorney's offices, is that it brings pressure to bear on the unit itself from people within the system. And you certainly are no stranger to that. I mean, you've gotten pushback from police, from justices, from people within the district attorney's office as you've done your work.
No question. And just to kind of harken back to what I said just a minute ago, when the conversation was first being had about who should be doing this work, at that time, everybody knew that the Innocence Projects were doing it. But the question was, can you actually expect the Innocence Projects to be able to handle the problem by themselves? And I think the answer is a resounding no. There is no question that prosecutors and police play a huge role. In fact, probably one of the most significant roles in contributing to the problem. So to me, it makes sense that they are actually also part of the solution. One thing that is certainly important to highlight when you compare prosecutors being able to do the work with the Innocence Project is oftentimes the prosecutors have the access to the information. In other words, they have the keys or the missing pieces of the puzzle. They also have the resources. And so it is just necessary that they are part of the solution to the problem.
And yet there are prosecutors who would resist that, I would think, because nobody wants to be wrong.
Absolutely. There's lots of prosecutors that resist it. There's lots of prosecutors that don't understand it. But more and more, what we see is prosecutors coming to the table and accepting that something has to be done.
There's been pushback from judges as well who are of the opinion that units like the CIU should not be working with defense attorneys, that there's this sort of sleeping with the enemy kind of dynamic going on.
Yeah, and it makes me sad because the reality is there ought not be any thinking of an enemy, to be honest with you. Our criminal justice system works only if all of the stakeholders within the system understand and appreciate the roles that they have. And too often, judges and other folks misunderstand what the role of a prosecutor is. If you go back and you look at United States Supreme Court cases as far back as almost 100 years, the United States Supreme Court reminds us that a prosecutor's job is not to win cases. A prosecutor's job is to do justice. And sometimes that means taking off your adversarial hat, putting on a collaborative hat, and saying, we got it wrong, and now we need to fix it.
And then, of course, there is the relationship with police officers. And there's, you know, no doubt those who are wanting to make sure that everything is done properly. But there's also been some pushback and some sort of give and take in trying to work together with police to address these issues.
No question. And that's going to continue to be the case. And I think a lot of what we can do as a criminal justice system and as a community is to try to educate the police so that they understand that when we have conviction integrity units doing this kind of work, it is not a personal attack on the police department. Instead, it is, as I've said already, it is an attempt to say, as human beings, we make mistakes. And as human beings, when we recognize that those mistakes have been made, we need to correct them.
There is also a police misconduct database that's part of all this. Tell me about that and what that's used for.
It's fascinating to me because we started working on the police misconduct disclosure database long before George Floyd and all that we've seen in the uprisings over the last year and a half. Specifically, the way that came about was very early on in Larry Krasner's tenure, a story came out in the media about how prior administrations had dealt with issues of divulging or disclosing information regarding police officer misconduct. When that story came out, at the same time a question was asked, what are you going to do about that, Larry Krasner? What's your policy going to be? So at that point in time, the DA elected me and my unit to spearhead a research project into figuring out historically how it had been handled and also how we were going to handle it moving forward. It's crazy to me because it's not anything new. The idea that a prosecutor has an obligation to disclose police officer misconduct in pending criminal cases has been around for many years. I mentioned at the beginning of this program that we've got the Brady obligation to disclose favorable information to the defense, but we also have an obligation to disclose information that we consider impeaching. And very simply put, what that means is if we have information that goes to the credibility of a witness we're relying on to prove somebody committed a crime, we got to disclose that information. And that really is kind of the rich source of the need for a police misconduct disclosure database. Police officers often are the only witnesses to prove up a crime. So if a police officer as a witness has engaged in various types of misconduct, that is information that not only the defense should know about, but prosecutors should know about it as well. We need to know about the people that we're relying on to prove that an individual committed a crime, especially because often we're trying to deprive them of their liberty.
Much more Radio Times when we come right back, including someone who spent many years in jail for a crime he did not commit.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about Philadelphia's Conviction Integrity Unit. It's part of the District Attorney's Office, and it has helped to exonerate 21 people over the last 4 years. In fact, we're talking about a recent report from the office that highlights numerous examples of official misconduct, which led to the incarceration of many innocent people, including withholding exculpatory evidence, perjury, evidence tampering, coercing false convictions. We are discussing all of that with the head of the Conviction Integrity Unit, Patricia Cummings. But we also have with us someone who knows this painfully well, and that is Theophilus Bilal Wilson, who was exonerated last year after serving 28 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit. We will get to him in just a moment, but I do want to invite our listeners to join in the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, or you can always give us a call at 888-477-9499. Again, we're talking with Patricia Cummings from the District Attorney's Office Conviction Integrity Unit, and Theophilus Bilal Wilson is on the phone. Bilal, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, everyone.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Bilal, you were accused of taking part in a triple murder that took place when you were 17 years old. You received a sentence of life without parole. What kept you going day after day, year after year, for 28 years in prison, knowing that you were innocent?
Well, one of the things is that I did is I prayed a lot. I kept faith. And I started to study law. And I knew that was the only way that I was going to be able to, with the help of God, be able to regain my freedom one day.
So you said
a lot of prayer, and I started studying.
And so as you were studying law in an effort to build a case for yourself, it sounds like, from what I have read, that for a long time you didn't have any legal help. So how were you able to get your case reviewed?
Well, I mean, I my family, over the years, they was able to do fundraisers for me to gather money to hire attorneys. And when the money ran out several different times, I had to be knowledgeable about the law. So I had to keep my litigation afloat. So, and that's what I did. So I studied law, and I filed many pro se petitions.
And by pro se, you mean that you filed them on your own as opposed to having an attorney file them for you. So it sounds like it was a team effort, that you had a whole group of people behind you trying to support you in this effort, raise the funding, and help you get your case in front of the right people.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Bilal, take us back to that moment in the courtroom when the judge told you that after 28 years behind bars, that you were free to go home.
I mean, I can't, I can't put no words in it. It just was awesome. I mean, it was wonderful. It was kind of like unbelievable. It was beautiful. It was a great day.
What's the first thing you did when you left the courthouse?
I got a cup of coffee. Well, I thanked God, and then I got a cup of coffee and a cannoli. Lots of cannoli.
I think that's a great way to start post-prison life, is with some coffee and a cannoli. Bilal, did you ever receive an apology or any kind of compensation for all that you went through?
Yes, I actually received a well-worn felt apology from Patricia Cummings in the District Attorney's Office. In terms of compensation, I didn't receive any compensation.
Mm. I want to bring Patricia into the conversation at this point to talk about, because Bilal said that you offered that apology to him, and to talk about the importance. What's the significance of having, even apart from financial compensation, an apology?
Wow. There's actually a lot of studying going on about the criminal justice system, the legal system, really, in general, and how we fail in understanding the strength and importance of apologies. I remember actually getting to listen to an expert talk about that, and that was several years ago, and I was really struck by it. And part of what I learned from that was that lawyers are really kind of taught to do the opposite. And so with the work that I do, I was just absolutely floored by it. So it's always been important to me to understand it, know that it has been non-existent, and quite frankly, to do it. And I started doing that when I was doing this work in Texas. And when I came to Philadelphia, there was not even a moment's consideration that I would do anything different. the sad reality is, as important as it is just kind of the beginning of the recovery process for somebody like Bilal that he has to go through. But we all know words are important. And so from my perspective, it's a good, easy thing to do.
And Bilal just mentioned that he has not received financial compensation. Can you speak generally about that? Is that ever part of this process as you're working to get people exonerated? Is there an opportunity for financial recourse for the years that they've spent, the years of their lives that they've lost?
There should be. And I'm going to speak really from a national perspective to answer your question and kind of set the table for the issue. And that is, as we've learned more about wrongful convictions over the last several decades, many legislatures throughout our country have kind of kept up with that. In other words, they have understood the responsibility the government bears for wrongfully convicting somebody and incarcerating the innocent. And so legislatures, in fact, right now we've got 2/3 of the legislative bodies on a state basis in this country have passed what we call compensation statutes. And it is a way for people like Bilal to go in and, depending on the state, you fill out your paperwork and the state pays you for every year that you have been wrongfully incarcerated. Unfortunately, even though I said 2/3 of the states have done it, Pennsylvania falls in the third of the states that have not. Mm-hmm. And Pennsylvania, and this is much to my surprise and my sorrow, but Pennsylvania just lags behind not only in compensation statutes, but also in so many things that could be done to help protect those that have been wrongfully convicted, but also help try to ensure that we don't continue to do it.
Bilal, I'm coming back to you in just a moment, but Patricia, one other question, and that is there a way to know on average what does someone receive as compensation per year of wrongful incarceration?
So, of course, there's a way to know. What I would recommend people take a look at is there's all kinds of studies that have been done that kind of do a state-by-state analysis of what individuals receive in compensation. And when we're talking about compensation statutes and not lawsuits, you can get a feel for sometimes the state offers, quite frankly, I'm going to say as low as $25,000 a year, and some states offer as high as $80,000 a year. So it really depends on how the legislation was written that will then determine how much an individual receives. You know, and it's complicated. But at the end of the day, states stepping up to the plate is something that is necessary. And hopefully what Pennsylvania will do is step up to the plate soon and do it in a way that's meaningful so it recognizes the value of each year of Bilal's life that was lost to this wrongful incarceration.
Yeah. Bilal, let's talk about those years. And before I get to my question, let me remind our listeners that you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Bilal Wilson, we've been talking about your years, 28 of them in prison for a triple murder that you were not involved in. Tell us about those years, about being behind bars, the challenges that you faced in that environment for such a long time.
Well, it's hard. It would take maybe years to explain all the details of that horrific situation. It's very traumatizing. It's sad. It's depressing. Sometimes you feel a sense of hopelessness. It's lonely. You lose a lot of family members. You lose a lot of friends. It's not a good place. It's not a good environment. So what a person has to do is, or what I did was, I just, you know, like I said, prayed a lot, and I used studying and knowledge as a way to try to numb the pain to about a 1% degree. And that 1% degree was allowed me to, like, you know, to not, you know, not to give up. It's a lot of things, and that's a lot of things personally going on with yourself in there, and then you have all the negativity around you. So you have to try your best, and I try my best to navigate around those things. I try my best to exercise, when I could, and just, prayed hard and worked hard. So that was able to keep the balance from the trauma and the horrific experience from, consuming me, And I always believed that hate erodes the container, so I tried my best not to have that emotion. And, I did a pretty good job at not having that emotion. But all the other emotions, the negative ones, they consume you in there. So hate is that ingredient that really just, it's a very bad mix. So what I tried to do is I said, listen, I'm here, I'm not supposed to be here, and I'm up.
So, Bilal, you said that when you were released, you said there are a lot of other innocent people in jail. And yeah. A couple of questions. One is, did you experience any sort of survivor's guilt isn't the right term, but I think you know what I mean, in yeah. being able to go home knowing that there were others who were still there?
Well, I call it survivor's guilt. You hit the head on the nail on the head. I call it survivor's guilt. And it's a thing that when you're in a traumatic situation with some people or with people, some people like myself feel a need and an urge to help. And I call it survivor's guilt. And this is why when I said, I'm blessed. If I'm blessed to ever get out of here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to help. Because there is a lot of people there that have been wrongfully convicted, whether actually innocent or their constitutional rights been trampled upon intentionally. So I mean, it's survivor guilt for me, but it's a strong motivator, and I'm highly motivated.
So how are you channeling that survivor's guilt, as you call it? What are you doing to try to help those who are still there, who you believe are innocent and should be on the other side?
Well, what we did was we said, how could we do it? And, as specific and as broad, if we can bring the two terms together, as good as we can. So what we did was we started a nonprofit. The nonprofit is called Before It's Too Late. So the foundation is called BITTLE. It's an acronym which means Before It's Too Late. And what we did was we our 501c3 status is pending as we speak. What we're doing is the front end, because we want to give back to the community from our experiential knowledge. We're trying to help the youth. We're trying to get the youth and teach the youth and help the youth before they develop an ideology of violence, which leads to incarceration. And at back end, we're trying to help those who've been wrongfully convicted regain their freedom before they die in jail. So we started a nonprofit to really give back specifically and collectively to the community at large, which is our youth, trying to help them, trying to stop them, trying to get them before they get this ideology that leads to violence and incarceration and crime. We're trying to get the youth, the young people. And then at the back end, we're trying to help those who've been wrongfully convicted regain their freedom before they die in jail. So this was the best way that we could do it. And it takes a lot of money. So we said we start a nonprofit and we'll get funding and we'll be able to help and hire good lawyers and good investigators. And we'll be able to hire some good people to help stem this, to help curb and try to prevent some of this violence in our community. So that's what we've done. That's how we're giving back.
Bilal, when it comes to the young people and sort of the prevention side of things, what are you doing to try to help young men and women keep out of the criminal justice system?
Well, we began. We have a curriculum, and we have programming curriculum. And just to give you a short version of what we do or what we've been doing, is that we're talking to the kids and we're trying to find out. We're gathering data and we're trying to ask the kids, "What's wrong? What's wrong with y'all?" In other words, we're not talking at them. We're letting them speak to us. What's wrong? Why this? Why that? Talk to us. We're not here to attack you. We're not here to condemn you. We're saying, what's wrong? What's the trauma? Let's talk. And that is very effective. When you sit down with some youth and the things that we heard, they need some love. And you know, it comes from the community. It takes a village to raise children, and that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Bilal, there was a co-defendant in your case, Christopher Williams, who got the death penalty for his alleged involvement in those murders. He was also held on another murder. He was exonerated. He was released from prison earlier this year. And I was reading that you gave some advice to his family as they were preparing to receive him back. What advice did you have for his family or for other families who are hoping that one day they're going to get their loved one back?
Well, I told him, I mean, in the short version, I told him, listen, he needs some love. He also needs not only love, but he also needs his space. He needs a lot of understanding. And he just needs, you know, he needs a hug. Because he's been through a whole lot, and you'll have to be patient with him. And sometimes it's going to take a lot of patience. But you got to be patient. You got to understand or try to understand or want to understand the trauma that he's been through. The man was on death row for 25 years, okay? And then turned around and was locked up some more years due to the fact that what else he was charged with. And so you got to give him some love. He needs a hug. A grown man needs a hug. He needs a hug and he needs some love. And he needs some peace and quiet. And that was the short version that I told him. And I told him I'll be here to help him.
Yeah. Bilal, in our last 45 seconds before I have to take a break here, what about you and your adjustment process? After 28 years in jail, what was adjustment like for you being on the other side?
Oh, man, I mean, the euphoria is the euphoria of just being free and being able to, you know, and having family and friends. It's been a struggle. You know, it's hard, you know, financially. And just wanting to do things, you know, being a man, wanting to be responsible for myself and my family. You know, financially it's hard. I've been around family and friends, man, and just trying to help people.
Yeah.
You know, and taking a lot of walks in the park and riding my bike and things like that, and just, you know, trying to go to supermarket and stuff and buy food. And I mean, it's been difficult,
yeah,
but, you know.
But good therapeutic things. Bilal, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for me because I have to take a quick break here. We are talking about wrongful convictions and what's being done to overturn them in Philadelphia. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office and its Conviction Integrity Unit, which was formed several years ago to help identify those people who were wrongly convicted and get them exonerated. We've been talking with Patricia Cummings, who is the head of the CIU, about the work that they've been doing over these years. 21 people so far have been exonerated, but there is a backlog of something like 1,100 cases yet to be reviewed. We've also been talking with Theophilus Bilal Wilson, who was exonerated last year after serving 28 years in prison on charges of a triple murder that he was not involved in. He has since been exonerated. He's been with us as part of this conversation. We invite you to join the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Patricia Cummings, I have a comment here from a listener who says, as listening to Bilal's story, at what point are the people who destroyed this man, his family, and friends held accountable?
Unfortunately, I can't say that there is a point where that happens. I've answered this question before, and I think sometimes I leave people very dissatisfied with what I have to say because bottom line is it's complicated. And I don't think that's the answer we want to hear when we see conduct that leads to such devastating effects. But what we do know is that at least we're having conversations about it. And once again, when we have conversations, you have people kind of falling on all ends of the spectrum. Some people will say that it is just a negligent mistake of the system, thus there really shouldn't be any accountability in the real sense that I think that the listener is asking, which is there criminal responsibility? But most of the time you hear it's a mistake. So what we need to do is we need to learn and we need to put policies and procedures in place to try to prevent it from happening. However, I know it's not always just negligence. I know that sometimes this sort of thing happens based on intentional or reckless behavior. And I believe when we are able to show that, there indeed should be some accountability. And that could be anything ranging from lawyers who maybe lose their license to practice law to civil liability of police officers that engage in a pattern in practice. Mm-hmm. And finally, criminal responsibility if, in fact, a crime can be proven. I just think all too often people in the system are just so afraid to go there. And I find it ironic because what we do in the system, and when I say system, we're talking about criminal justice system, what we do on a daily basis is we judge people if we believe that they have engaged in criminal conduct. So I find it kind of mind-boggling that we have such difficulties in judging ourselves when, in fact, that conduct rises to the level of a crime.
Yeah. Every time, Patricia, that somebody is exonerated for a crime that they didn't commit, it then raises the question, well, who did? And so I guess my question is, how much energy is there once somebody is exonerated around going back and reopening old cases and then trying to find the real perpetrators?
Energy. There's always energy for it. But I can't just answer the question and leave it there because energy is not enough to solve the crime. What we know historically speaking is that in cases where DNA has exonerated an individual, those are the cases that seem most ripe for being able to prosecute the real perpetrator. And as I said earlier in the program, those cases are the gold standard because the DNA tells us who didn't do it and sometimes who did. And so when we have that kind of scientific evidence, prosecuting somebody for a crime they committed 30 years ago is actually doable. However, in circumstances like we see in Philadelphia, we are not having DNA that's leading to the exoneration, and hence we don't have the DNA to point us in the direction of the real perpetrator. So then you were faced with, although you may have the energy, very often you don't have the evidence or you don't, unfortunately, have the resources. Because from a prosecutor's point of view, although I may think I've got evidence that points in one direction, I've also got to have the resources in terms of the investigative help to try to bring that person to justice. And I want to just illustrate one example of a problem we have in Philadelphia, and that's the case of Walter Ogrod and the brutal murder of Barbara Jean Horn. In our report, we actually put a link to a quote where the Philadelphia Police Department, in particular the homicide unit, essentially said they don't have the time, they don't have the resources to go back and try to figure out who killed Barbara Jean. And I am sympathetic. Part of what they said when they provided that answer is they're, you know, trying to keep their head above water dealing with the crimes that are happening today. And so based on that, they don't have, at least they said, they don't have the resources to go back and investigate these cases. And I think that is an unfortunate reality of the world that we're living in.
Well, right. And then that raises the question about, you know, victims and their families who may either question the exoneration or be faced with the process of starting the search for justice all over again.
Right. And we don't hear enough about victims in regard to wrongful convictions. Part of the reason why we don't hear enough is because as human beings, we find ourselves sympathizing with folks like Bilal because it's like our worst nightmare. Couldn't imagine surviving if I am put in that position. Wonder how my mother would survive if she was put in that position. So we've got a lot of empathy for that. But what a lot of people don't stop and think is that in addition to the trauma that Bilal and his family went through, think about the victim's family, because the victim's family certainly were victimized over 30 years ago when the crimes were committed, but then they're told that justice was obtained. And then all of a sudden, they're told, nope, you got it wrong. And so they relive it. And then add another layer where now they're kind of stuck with, well, who did it? And whoever did it may still be out there. And should I be afraid that they're out there? So you've got all of that you've got to deal with.
Yeah, it raises a whole other host of questions. Bilal, you've been standing by patiently. And when we left off, you were talking about the adjustment that it's been now that you have been back home for a year or so. But another question that I had for you that I didn't get to ask you earlier was just about something that Patricia and I talked about early in our conversation, which is that overwhelmingly, the people that we're talking about here are Black men. And as a Black man, I'm interested in your thoughts around the fact that so often this is who we're talking about, the people who get caught up in the situation that you were caught up in.
Well, speaking on race, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, math don't lie. The data don't lie. The vast majority of the people who've been wrongfully convicted are minorities, Black more than any other nationality. It's sad. I mean, we're living in America, and with this undercurrent of racism, it makes for a bad recipe when it comes to justice. We have law enforcement officers, prosecutors, and judges who may have that racism in them. It makes bad for justice. And it's going to take a team effort with regards to, you know, the district attorney, the police officers, and the judges, you know, to be fair and don't see it based upon race, you know. And it's a difficult thing to do, but, you know, we have to work towards doing that, you know. I think that we have to do something with the 13th Amendment, because the 13th Amendment still, you know, agrees with slavery. And I think that people who are racist, they hide in law enforcement, and this is the way that they're able to get, you know, to get their racist agenda on. So I think that we need to do something with the 13th Amendment that sanctions slavery if a person commits a crime. You know, we have to come away from that racism. You know, it's not good.
Patricia, on that note, The district attorney's report certainly shines a spotlight on those that he says have convicted or contributed to wrongful convictions. But there are certainly lots of police officers, prosecutors, judges who go to work every day wanting to do their work in an honorable way and see that justice really is served. And I wonder, does a report like this make it somewhat difficult for your colleagues in the criminal justice system who really are trying to do the right thing?
First, absolutely, you're right. The vast majority of people that serve as police officers and prosecutors are good people trying to do the right thing. And I never, ever intend to say anything otherwise. But like so many things we have in life, there are some people that are bad apples. There are some people that make mistakes. And we cannot be afraid of calling that out when it exists. And we have to be strong to understand that in doing so, we're not compromising what all of the other folks are doing. In fact, I think doing this, and in particular issuing a report like we did in June, actually is a good thing for the folks in the system trying to do the right thing. if we ignore it, what is our system?
There's a question from a listener who says, and this harkens back to something we spoke about a few minutes ago, are they ever going to change the law so that people who are exonerated will be able to receive compensation without having to go through the lengthy legal process? And we're speaking specifically about a state like Pennsylvania.
And I'm an optimist, so the answer to that is yes. The question that we don't know the answer to is when. There have been attempts for multiple sessions at the State House in Harrisburg to pass a compensation law in Pennsylvania. They just have not been successful. The time's going to come when the legislature, in its wisdom, is going to say, we got to do it, and we got to do it now because it is the right thing legally and it's the right thing morally.
And Patricia, it's one thing to correct the mistakes of the past, but it's another thing to try to prevent them from happening in the first place. That's sort of the flip side of it. How is that being addressed, to try to reduce the number of wrongful convictions that take place in the first place?
First, let me answer it just kind of on a national level. It's being addressed in a multitude of ways. CIUs throughout the country are not just tasked with looking at old cases. They are also tasked with understanding why things went wrong in the old cases. And when you understand what went wrong, you are then armed with the knowledge of what needs to be done to prevent it from happening in the future. So you will see everything from trainings that are taking place nationally to locally here in Philly, to people getting together and saying, you know what, we need to not only educate ourselves, we need to educate the community. And if we educate the community, we may then be successful in the legislature to pass laws that will give us the safety net that we need to prevent some of this stuff from happening.
Yeah. No one knows better than you, Patricia Cummings, that the wheels of justice tend to turn slowly, and that the quest for justice can be frustrating at best. You've experienced that time and again. And I just wonder, what keeps you going in the face of the pushback that you receive, the setbacks that you experience, the anger, the backlog of cases? Why do you keep doing this?
It's the most fulfilling thing I can do, not only as a lawyer, but as a human being, because I'm able to help people. And, you know, sometimes I remind myself you help them one person at a time. But when you do, like when you get to meet people like Bilal, it gives you the energy and the drive that you need to keep kind of plugging away at it. Mm-hmm. No matter how many times people punch you in the process, you keep going.
Yeah. And Bilal, for you, in our last couple of minutes here, you've been talking about the work that you have been doing on the front end to keep young people out of the criminal justice system, but also on the other side, trying to get people who are wrongly convicted out of prison. Now that you've been out for over a year yourself, what do you see as your life's work going forward? What do you want to do with the rest of your life?
Well, like Patricia, I'm cautiously optimistic as to, you know, reform, justice reform. And I'm like Patricia. I just like to help people. I want to hopefully, you know, put my life back together, whatever that looks like, and continue to help people. You know, this is my calling, and this is what I do. So, just, you know, trying to enjoy life and, you know, travel and see the world and help the people. You know, help the community and, you know, try to make life good.
And Patricia, before we go, just about resources to be able to do your job with the kind of backlog that you're looking at, I would think that would take a lot of resources. Where does the funding come from? How do you find enough attorneys and money to make all this work?
The resources come from a variety of places. First and foremost, I've got to applaud Larry Krasner because he made a commitment to provide the resources to the unit back in 2017 when he was running for district attorney, and in 2018 when he asked me to lead the unit. And so what he has been able to do is make sure that it is a priority in the office, and what that has amounted to is providing the support staff, paralegals, providing lawyers. But I got to say that in and of itself is not enough. Every district attorney's budget, including our own, is certainly not ever growing and vast to cover all the needs. So you have to also look to other sources. And that's exactly what we've done here in Philly. And that is we have looked to grant funding to help fund some of our projects. And we've been very lucky, if I say so. And that's enabled us to provide more help for people like Bilal when he was pro se. But it's also enabled us to take a deep dive into some of the issues that we've seen that lead to wrongful convictions.
Well, I think we will have to leave it there for today. Patricia Cummings is head of the Conviction Integrity Unit at the DA's office. Bilal Wilson, freed after 28 years in jail for a crime you didn't commit. Thank you both so much for being with us on Radio Times. Our producers are Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler, and our engineer is Diana Martinez.